Right. So when we hire somebody, they go through a little bit of a process. They sit down with one of our members of staff, an interview. If he thinks it's a good fit, it goes on to the owner. If Jim, the owner, thinks it's a good fit, then he's sent out to have a fingerprint background check, have a full complete physical. He's drug tested, he's alcohol tested, or she. And if everything comes back good, then they go out behind the wheel, and I do the driver training for the company. I have the final say of yes or no for this driver, chauffeur. And I got caught on that. Don't let my drivers who sit in the back know that. We take the duty of care very seriously, along with some other companies that are here. I know Royal Coastman does also, and BBZ. We take that duty of care. We're even part of the Department of Transportation. For our vehicles, we got it documented. We change a light bulb, it has to be put on there. So we take the duty of care very seriously. And I thank you. I know the discussion is going to be great. Again, yeah. Looking forward to it. And go ahead.
Thank you again. Thanks so much for the food and everything. It was terrific. So, but before we start the program, I just wanted to give you an update on our Executive Leadership Committee. As I said, I'm the president. We've had a few changes as folks had some business needs that needed to move out of certain roles and into others. Bruce Boyota is our vice president. Recently, Laura Goldberg has moved into the secretary position, as well as Karen Panicciulli has moved into the treasurer position. We have two open positions on our committees now. We have government relations, which I'll talk a little bit about, and then the PR and sponsorships position is open. If you're interested in any of those or want to learn more about them, please reach out to me or Bruce after the session here. Then memberships, we have Thomas Bueller and Zorian Ricks. Programs is Renee Frumafredo. Sites, that person puts together the where we're going to have our meetings. That's Christina Mendez. Sean Collins, he was our PR and sponsorship, and he's moved in now to web chair and technology. And then we have Tim Rossini as our education and scholarships chair. We have availability to be co-chairs. If you're interested in getting more involved, please see me after the session. All right, and the business travel pack. We had the raffle, right? We were giving out the raffle tickets, right? So you saw what that was all about. I just want to give you a little bit more background about what the pack is. As we will be bringing in the 45th President of the United States tomorrow, this is our political action committee. This is how we stay connected to Washington. It's the only federally recognized PAC representing the business travel industry, and it gives us that voice in the political process. You can actually join in on this process, and we have scholarships for this. The Legislative Symposium takes place in April 24th to the 26th in Washington, D.C. This is also part of the role of the government liaison, pulling this together, bringing people with him or her to Washington, where you meet one-on-one with your senators and representatives in your district. So you meet, if you live in a certain county, that's who you go and see. You learn about the congressional debates and the outcomes that will impact the travel business. You hear from perspectives from the administration, officials, and members of Congress. It's an exciting time. It'll give you a whole new outlook on the political process, I promise you. I've been there. Several of us have gone. It's an excellent opportunity. And as I said, we do offer scholarships for this. So if you're interested, please see one of us after the presentation. All right, so without any further delay, I'm going to bring up Michael Baker. He's the senior editor for transportation for the BTN Group, and he'll tell you a little bit about himself, and then he'll introduce the wonderful panel to you. Michael.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. So it's really my pleasure to be here today. A little background on myself. I've been with the BTN Group for almost 11 years now. It'll be 11 years in February, and when I first started out, the ground transportation was kind of lumped in with the payment at that point in time, which is where everyone started. So I started with that, and then I moved on. I did hotels for about 8 years after that. And then I got pulled into doing the airline side of things, which by that time, ground transportation had moved to the airline beat, all lumped into transportation. So right back where I started from. So it's my pleasure. So I wanted to start with just take a little poll of the room and see where we are. First of all, I'd just like all the buyers to raise their hands, please. Okay, great. So keep your hands up. And so Of all the buyers, how many of you allow your travelers to use Lyft or Uber or similar type of service? Okay, great. Keep your hands up if you have your hands up. So those of you, how many of you actually have either addressed this in policy or are working with one of these suppliers? Okay, so a handful, somewhat.
In conversation.
All right, great. So we'll talk about that in a bit. So it's interesting. I think if we had taken this poll even, you know, a couple years ago, it would have looked very different. So with BTN, the travel buyers are our primary audience, and we interact with them a lot, not only in events like this, but you know, we have our own advisory panel, things like that. And you know, when Uber and Lyft were first starting to emerge, at that point in time, a lot of the buyers we were talking to were taking a pretty hard line against it. They were banning it. They said they wouldn't reimburse travelers if they use these services. Some of them were even kind of looking at ways to build their own in-house versions of these. And then, fast forward a little bit, we kind of saw more of a head in the sand approach where, you know, they would allow it, but they didn't want to address it in policy. It's like, well, we know they're using it, and we'll reimburse it, but we're not going to talk about it. And now, as we see, we're seeing, you know, companies looking either to address it in policy in some way or another, or, you know, work with the suppliers. So it's that's kind of what we'd like to talk about today. So I want to start out with just a few numbers. Okay, so there's expense reporting companies certified. I don't know if you guys are familiar with them or not. And just to caveat on the data, they're of course not the biggest expense supplier out there, but they do kind of quarterly data where they take a look at the receipts that they processed. And in 2015, they noted that was the point in time where the number of receipts from Uber and Lyft had outpaced taxis and car rental companies. And it's not really apples to apples when you take a car rental receipt versus a receipt, you know that. But that they pointed out that milestone. And then last year, the receipts from Uber and Lyft outpaced both of those combined. So a different kind of look at things. You know, BTN, we have what we call the CT100. That's the top 100 companies based on U.S. book travel spend. So we survey those every year in a report. And in our most recent survey, which came out in September or October, I can't remember, we asked these companies, and 40% of them said they allow use of services like Uber and Lyft. That's a higher percentage than people who are looking at other emerging travel opportunities like open booking, say virtual cards, or Airbnb, which we're not going to talk about today. A whole different world we don't want to go into. But I also suspect that if you surveyed employees of those CT100 companies, that the percentage of people who are actually using it would be a lot higher than 40% as well. So the point is that ride-sharing or on-demand transportation, whatever you want to call it, there's a whole different names. It's here. It's not going anywhere. So the next hour and a half or so, we're going to be talking about how to handle it. And we have a great panel. Nobody's going to be giving any presentations other than what I just said now. We're going to have everyone briefly introduce themselves, and we're going to launch right into questions and answers. So the second you have a question, please put up your hand, and we'll get to you right away. So first of all, we have kind of someone from each side. So kind of from the traditional transportation side, if you'd like to call it that, we have John Epstein, Royal Coachman. John, you want to briefly introduce yourself and give a little background?
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me. My name is John Epstein. I'm president of Royal Coachman Worldwide, located in Denville, New Jersey. We service the tri-state area, and of course, we service the world as well, like most companies in the transportation area today. I'm a charter board member of the Losing Association of New Jersey, which is commonly known as LANJ. I currently serve as the first vice president and treasurer of that organization. I'm also involved with the National Limousine Association and serve on various committees with that. With LANJ, I spent quite a bit of time down in Trenton, fighting on behalf of the ground transportation industry, testifying before Senate subcommittees, assembly subcommittees, and such. Currently, we have a couple bills in the governor's desk right now waiting for signature. One I'm sure Zach is excited about, too, which is the rideshare bill, which is A3695, which we are both pushing to have signed. The other is A3696, which is the elimination of sales tax on service for limousine companies in New Jersey. I'm not sure how many of you know about that, but that's a fight we're putting. And if that goes through, that will lower your limo cost by 7%. So that is on the governor's desk for signature. We've worked hard to get that to try to level the playing field. None of the other transportation entities, such as taxis, funeral services, and TNCs, are subject to the tax. and we only feel it's equity that way. So we're pushing for that, and feel free to write the governor, and if you need contact information, I'll be happy to give it to you.
Great. Thank you, John. Okay, next up, we have Zach Austin with Lyft. He's representing the emerging technology side. Zach, you want to tell us a little about yourself?
Yeah, first off, Michael and Bruce, thank you so much for inviting us today. Really honored to be on a panel with two leaders in the corporate travel space, really excited to be just up here with such esteemed panelists. I'm Zach Austin. I work in corporate partnerships at Lyft, the on-demand ride-hailing service. Lyft operates in about 230 markets in the United States. Was founded in 2011 by two founders who actually had just been on a trip to Zimbabwe, and they noticed that in kind of the absence of any sort of public transportation infrastructure, that a network of minibuses had sprung up around the cities. People needed a way to get from point A to point B, and that the community actually came up with essentially a private market solution in lieu of taxis or in the absence of any sort of public buses or transportation or anything like that. Our founders saw that, and they really had a vision that they brought back to the United States. Both our founders grew up in Los Angeles, and they hate traffic, understandably, if you grew up there. I think you can say the same thing about the tri-state area as well. And they realized that there was a real opportunity to, one, create up all these cars that are sitting on sidewalks and parking lots, driveways, around the United States. Actually, the average car is used about 4% of the time. The other 96% of the time, it sits unused in a driveway somewhere. And they realized what a massive economic drain that was. They saw traffic and all the time people spend sitting in their cars. And they realized they saw an opportunity for a better way. What if we can create a network of shared rides, normal everyday people who can utilize their cars to make money, to supplement their existing income by giving rides to people who need rides to go somewhere. Now, that was sort of the vision, and the growth of Lyft has been phenomenal in the past 5 years. In 2016, we did 14 million rides around the country. And I joined as part of a new team about a year ago that was really in response to a huge level of demand from the corporate space. Travel leaders like yourselves that were seeing receipts for Uber and Lyft showing up on their expense reports. They were getting questions from their employees about this new solution and whether they could take it for work. So I've had the opportunity to work with some really phenomenal corporate partners in my time at Lyft, and really helping those here in the room and elsewhere understand how their employees might be using Lyft, and helping them adapt their policies to really what is, as Michael mentioned with some of his statistics, kind of a rapidly oncoming future that it's already here. So really excited to speak today, and looking forward to addressing any questions or just educating this group about Lyft and ride-hailing in general.
Great, thanks, Zach. Now, I've been covering you guys for a few years, and that's the first time I ever heard the origin story from Zimbabwe, so I didn't know that. All right, finally, we have representing the buyer perspective. We have John Wolliver. He's the Senior Director of Procurement for and Travel at Broadridge Financial Solutions. John has done some work with incorporating these vendors into his travel program. He's going to talk about that in a bit, but John, first, you want to just introduce yourself and give yourself give us a little background.
Sure, thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for having me again. Yes. I was on a panel last year, also at another ad location, and actually it was a third party, so a hotel. So it's wonderful to be back, and aside from being the referee in between, it's funny for those. I see some familiar faces in the crowd. For those of you that know me on the professional side, I'm very much a solutions driver. I'm looking for opportunities to fill holes and figure out what solutions work for you as a traveler, whether you work for me, for my company, or if we're peers and we're talking about solutions. So that's a personal driver, and one I think Nancy Michaels, who's joining me from my company as well, she's our travel admin in the back. that's one of our goals. And historically, financial services, I work for Broadridge Financial Solutions, which is a financial services company. And so historically, we're very, very buttoned up, very conservative. And so we're not a dot-com company. We're not a technology company where you take a lot of the philosophies and throw them out the window and do whatever you feel like doing. So for us, it was an opportunity really to look at both of the solutions and saying, okay, rather than ignore the new and emerging solutions, let's understand it and let's see how it could work. And so I think what we're going to talk about today is how we've done that as a buyer, but certainly with partners on either side of me to make it work for our entire travel population.
Great, thanks, John. All right, Zach, we'll start with you. So you work directly with corporate travel buyers. So how are you working with them? What are they coming to you with, and how are you addressing their concerns or questions, or how are you incorporating into their programs?
Yeah, absolutely. I alluded to this earlier. I think that a lot of the travel leaders in the room, they're obviously seeing the rise of ride sharing and Lyft in the consumer space, and they're starting to hear about it from their employees and seeing it show up on expense reports. And the 99% of the time, the first question that they have is duty of care. And I know that'll be a hot topic today. Lyft takes duty of care extremely seriously. I think it started with the fact that Lyft was the only ride sharing company that started with partnered with the state of California to actually create the first law that legalized ride sharing. We partnered with them. We were the primary driver of formally legalizing ride sharing in the state of California. We're really proud of that because that same legislation has now been adopted in some form in 39 different states. And we really gave, we really helped to start that. Lyft is also very much a values-driven company in that we put our people first. And another little known story about how Lyft started, you might be familiar with our pink mustache logo, and actually the origin of that was that originally our founders actually kind of founded Lyft on what they called the sister principle. They wanted to create a service that they felt comfortable with their sister using, or their wives, or their daughters, or their female friends, and it was originally conceptualized as female drivers and female passengers only. So that's actually how Lyft was originally conceptualized. Now, they realized it didn't make economic sense to eliminate half your potential market. So they did expand, and now anyone can drive for Lyft, provided they pass our very stringent system of background checks. Anyone can ride for Lyft. But that commitment to diversity remains. Actually, 30% of our drivers are women. And I think compared to the traditional ground transportation industry, and even to some other competitors in the ride-sharing space, it's really an unheard-of number. More than half of our executives are females as well. So we really take that diversity aspect very, very seriously, right? The second piece, we were the first ride-sharing company to offer $1 million in commercial liability insurance for every ride that's being offered. Now, in some cases with corporate partners that do require more, we have the ability to work with them to find a solution that works there. So that insurance aspect is something that a big part of what I do. Some companies do have higher requirements, and I'm really focused on helping customize a policy around that. And third is, I mentioned that duty of care. We treat our drivers extremely well. There's a survey recently of about 1,200 ride-sharing drivers, and 80% of them said they were happier driving for Lyft than they were for their competitors. They also said that they made more money with Lyft. Now, the reason why is a couple-fold. The first, we allow tipping on our platform, and it's done directly through the application. It's done after you get out of the car, so there's no request for cash or expectation that you have to give cash to someone. We've paid more than $150 million in tips to our drivers since our inception. And that is one of the number one reasons drivers love driving for Lyft. Now, we truly believe that cascades down to the experience that passengers have in the car. And we look at this as a hospitality business, which it really is at the end of the day. And when we focus on treating our drivers better, we feel that that really cascades down to a better experience for those in the vehicle. Now, when it comes to, I mentioned we treat our drivers very well, we also have extraordinarily high standards for who can drive on the Lyft platform. That starts with really our expectation that we meet every driver. I think we share a lot in that aspect. So every Lyft driver, we meet them in advance, and that's something that some competitors in the space can't say that they do. We also perform background checks using Sterling. Now, a good number of you in the room very well could be the background check service that your company uses for any incoming employees. It's the same background checks performed by the FBI, by the Department of Defense. We then have continual accountability after every ride. So we have a 5-star rating system. So every passenger rates their Lyft driver after every ride. If I perform 30 rides in a day, that's 30 ratings that I receive continually. And for a driver to drive on the Lyft platform, you have to maintain an average of 4.8 stars out of 5. If they dip below that, they're immediately suspended from the platform. We'll review any comments or what the issue may have been. Lastly, it's technology. And I think there's a really exciting opportunity with GPS tracking. You can share your location of any ride with friends and family. You obviously can see who your driver is in advance. You can easily get in touch with them. And we use really advanced language processing to monitor every comment left about a driver on the platform to detect for any potential issues, anything along those lines. So when you look at the really stringent level to comprehensively, we require that we want to meet you, we want to speak to you, we do a vehicle inspection and a driver's test, and then the continued accountability of being rated after every ride. We continually ensure that our drivers perform to the incredibly high standards that we hold for them. It was a bit of a mouthful, but very top of mind of this group, but something that we're extraordinarily focused on, and not only something that I think there's a lot of misconceptions around in the travel industry, but also ways that we strongly differentiate from others in the on-demand and app-based ride-hailing industry as well.
But they're independent contractors, so they don't actually get health benefits,
So that's a good question. Actually, 65% of the drivers on the Lyft platform are part-time, so they drive less than 40 hours a week. And you know, these are things like mothers or retirees who want to earn some additional cash. I think the economic opportunity that we create is really a powerful, it's really powerful. I think that $150 million in tips speaks for itself. Full-time employment driving for Lyft doesn't make sense for everyone, and frankly, it's sort of core to our model of having on-demand transportation. People can earn when they want, and people can ride when they want.
Do full-time employees get those sort of benefits?
Driver partners who drive more than 40 hours a week actually have extraordinary earning power. If you drive more than 40 hours a week, we actually don't charge a commission on any rides on the platform, so you have the opportunity to earn all of your commission back, along with additional power driver bonuses. So we do have for those that can and want to drive at that level, there are some really large financial incentives.
But there's no health benefits. They're not employees. No workers comp. No unemployment. No anything.
So the model is one that really is, we want to provide flexibility and the ability for drivers.
The question is just, are they employees and do they receive health benefits?
They just
yes or no.
Drive a car, and correct? I mean, they don't get all the benefits that somebody who works full time would get.
They are independent contractors.
Okay. And do you have that, and how long can they work as many hours a day, or is there a limit as to how many hours they can actually
drive? We do have driver limits. So they have to take a 6-hour break in any 16-hour period.
So we do work 16 hours straight?
No, there has to be a 6-hour break within those 16 hours.
And how do you monitor that?
It's all done through the app. So we have the driver app on their phone, we're monitoring that, and if someone hits their limit, we will deactivate them for that period of time.
So does the insurance come through you or the car insurance through the driver?
So
The
state laws that I mentioned earlier, the state mandates that every driver has to carry a level of insurance that is mandated by that state. It does vary. Lyft then offers a $1 million policy that sits on top of any insurance that the driver carries.
That insurance policy is only in effect when there's a passenger in the car. So if they're on their way to a job and they kill someone, that person who gets killed is stuck with the statutory minimum of the state.
The insurance does apply if they are driving to a, if they've hailed a passenger and they're on the way to pick that passenger up.
That's not the way it's gone down in all the lawsuits. The first person in San Francisco got killed by a Uber driver, a six-year-old girl, on her way to a pickup. And then state limits, Uber denied the claim because there was no passenger in the car, so state limits took over.
My understanding too, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding too is that frequently a lot of these drivers, because once the insurance company finds out that they're driving for a Lyft or an Uber, won't actually cover them if they are going to or from a job, because at that point they're their personal insurance is, they're considered on a commercial job. So there's a gap in some cases of when they hail to when they pick up a passenger, that driver may in fact not be insured, dependent upon the situation.
So I can't speak to Uber's insurance offering. To this point, I know that the insurance industry is equally catching up. We work really closely with the insurance industry. There's a lot of new insurance products that are specifically designed for those that are ride sharing. So there are products out there that you can purchase directly for that. And we work closely with the insurance industry, just as we do at the local, state, and federal level, to continue to be crafting policies that that ensure safe rides and coverage for everyone. I think one of the interesting things about a corporate traveler is that if I get in a cab in San Antonio, or if I get, let's say, in an independent black car in Miami, travel leaders, the level of insurance that those operators are required to carry, it varies by region to region, right? It's patchwork. I think one of the biggest shifts that corporate travel leaders are really leading into about the Lyft program is that they can have the confidence in the $1 million insurance coverage that we offer, no matter where in the country their employees are traveling.
How often do you revisit the drivers? So you meet them, you see their vehicles. How often do you a revisit and all of the rechecks? Because I know in the ground transportation, they do rechecks and drug testing and all that. How often?
There is a little bit of variance, again, based on state law and what's required in certain markets. I believe in California, it is as frequent as every month. But in most areas, it's quarterly that we do perform the criminal checks.
And who's doing the visiting? Like, would it be you, or do you have a whole team that does the meeting of the driver?
Yeah, we have a local operations team in all of our major markets, and then satellite operations teams that do the interviews, which are both a Lyft staff member and also a 5-star rated driver in the area. And the 5-star rated driver does the ride along with that individual.
And do you meet the driver and you see the car? Do you verify that the car belongs to them, it's registered, and it's properly insured?
Yes, we do.
I'm speaking as a fleet manager also, mm-hmm. with 550 drivers across the state who think that they now can take their company car and use it on off hours because we won't know about it.
Mm-hmm. So drivers
and it
do...
It is against our policy.
Yep.
However, I can't sit and watch across the country, but do you make sure that car is registered to that person specifically?
We do.
For any driver
to onboard with the Lyft platform, they have to provide proof of current registration and insurance.
Do you have telematics in any way, shape, or form that you can tell if a driver is having any kind of bad habits, excessive braking or, short stops, speeding? Any of the things that would normally tell you that this driver's a safety hazard?
So the way that we really analyze that, and it goes beyond just erratic driving, I think that we use some really powerful language processing technology to look at, I'd mentioned those ratings after every ride that take place. That's a really critical piece of it. I tell my corporate travel partners that it should be part of every communication.
So you rely on self-reporting.
That's right. And it can be, 20, 30, 40 trips a day.
And what if they don't survey? I never answer a survey. I just don't do it. So if they've done 30 rides and you're saying that they have to have 4.8 and only two people.
So the rating is required to process payment.
The rating's mandatory.
Within 24 hours.
But if somebody doesn't leave a comment, then you'll never know. If the person might rate them a 4.5 and get out of the car and say, wow, that was crazy, and just keep going.
What we've learned, I think, and I mentioned in 14 million rides last year, is that this is a really effective way to monitor for drivers that a passenger may feel unsafe. And the scale of which of operating these vehicles is, if anything, I think it's that level of accountability. The drivers also know they're being ridden, right? I think that's a powerful effect in and of itself. And one that we have a full dedicated 200-person staff in Nashville that's constantly monitoring all reports from around the country. And so that is something that we are constantly focused on. And that level of accountability, I think, is relatively unique when it comes to ratings after every trip and immediate feedback.
We'll take one more question, and we want to move on and let the other panelists talk a little bit. Then we'll come back to a lot of these issues as we go. We'll get more Zach and Ray. We had one question back there, I think.
After you start a new driver with his car, so 3 months later or 6 months later, how do you know he's not driving on bald tires, faulty brakes, one headlight out? How do you check that on an ongoing basis, the way the traditional companies do?
So there are reoccurring vehicle inspections. Again, it varies by market what the frequency is. I think it's that similar level of ratings and accountability that we provide through the app that provides day-to-day feedback about the performance of any driver. And if a passenger ever feels unsafe, that's something that we immediately act on, and they're deactivated.
So we'll come back to these, I promise. But I want to give John a chance to talk a little about how you work with corporate travel buyers and whether you see kind of your role, has it evolved as these kind of technologies emerge?
Well, our role is still the same in principle on what we do with our corporate travelers, and that is to provide safe and reliable ground transportation solutions for our customers. How do we do that? We do that a lot of ways. The first way, of course, is customer service. We give you someone to talk to, give you a point of contact. We give you someone that can work with to honor special requests, to handle your difficult travelers, because, God, we all know you have them, right? No question about that, just one. certain bottled water in the car, preferred chauffeurs, a six-pack of beer cold in the car. Yes, it does happen, right, Zareen? I mean, all kinds of things, the requests we get, you wouldn't believe it. So we do that. We also provide proper and continuous insurance. In New Jersey, the state minimum from limo law is 1.5 mil. Most have 5. We have 10 million coverage. And that is continuous all the time. There's no interruption in coverage at all. We have new and consistent vehicles that are properly maintained. They're evaluated every day. They go into the mechanic shop every 2-3 weeks. For oil changes and maintenance, they're constantly scrutinized. We have we provide qualified chauffeurs. And to what Sean said, his point exactly, we have chauffeurs. We don't have drivers. There's a huge difference. And we provide qualified chauffeurs who are all employees and not independent contractors by doing the following. We do proper background checks that include fingerprinting. That's the gold standard. It just is what it is. The cops use it. If you volunteer to be a Little League coach, you're fingerprinted. If you're a broker, you're fingerprinted. There's a reason why you're fingerprinted, because it's the best method of doing things. We also do pre-employment and random drug and alcohol testing. Huge. Ongoing. All right? They go in a pool, it's random selected pre-employment. We, and most companies that I'm aware of also, have one-week chauffeur training programs. Comprehensive customer service, dedicated safety personnel in our area who come in. They do a half-day in-class training, and then they go on the road for a half a day with them. Okay? Then we have senior chauffeur mentors. So that means that our new prospective applicant will go out with a senior chauffeur mentor for 2 full days and learn what he's supposed to do. Because being on the road and learning from an individual who's been doing it a while and he's tops in his field, it's a lot better than someone sitting in a classroom and telling you about it. We have confidentially non-disclosure signatures from all chauffeurs. Everything that's said in our cars stays in our cars. We do ghost rides to confirm quality. We send people out. A lot of times my friends who use us, I always send them new guys, new chauffeurs. They're always like, I have a new chauffeur again. Yeah, call me from the airport. We want to know how our new chauffeur's doing. This is important because you never know down the road, this person's going to handle one of your VIPs. We have continuing safety education that we do continuously through chauffeur meetings, through DriveCam, where they're self-taught and they're taught by our in-house personnel who handle that. And this is all to support a proper duty of care. I'm sure you all know that you are responsible for your employees from when they leave their house till they get back to their house. And that's a fact. Not doing drug tests and alcohol testing, not having fingerprinting, not having proper training, these are all things that hurt the duty of care.
Great, thanks, John. All right, so John.
What's the cost? You know, I don't know the cost for us. Do you know the cost of everything? Everything has a dollar figure.
Hard cost for us to train a guy, and this is just the immediate hard cost, this is not the soft cost involved with everyone else, is $945 just to train one chauffeur. And as we all know in our industry, and I'm looking at a lot of limo operators, they're shaking their head, you have 10 applicants, you put four into your training class, you get two when you're done, and one sticks.
Yep.
All right, that's what we go through. We go through it every day because we are super selective as to who we put on the road and represent.
Those actually like $4,000 just for that one employee all said and done.
Yeah, it's super costly. Yeah. You know, because what we do, which might be a little different, is before they go for their New Jersey limo license, we do a background check before we even start. Just because we want to make sure that we got someone we can deal with before we spend the additional money on the limo license for the fingerprinting and everything, which of course we pick up and we pay for all that.
Okay, great. All right, so John, you've dealt with this in your own travel program. How did you do it? What does your travel program look like?
Well, first of all, depending on your organization, you have upwards of four generations working for you. Yeah. Think about that. Okay. I'm proud to say, I'm 44 years old. I grew up with a set of parents that thought if you didn't talk about it, it didn't happen. Yes, I was partying a freshman in high school. Okay, I get it. So that didn't work in my house. If you ignore it or you choose not to look at it, you're doing yourself a disservice. All right. And I'll be quite frank with you. The interest, what I was bucketing the two services on demand and prearranged. I can't even do that anymore. Okay. But let's just think about it from that standpoint. There was tremendous amount of media buzz about the upcoming services of the Ubers, the Lyfts, and so forth. Tremendous media press, BTN covered it several times, right? So it became more of an eye-opener for me as a travel manager saying, hey, gosh, what are we doing? Are we using it? Are any of our folks using it? If they're not, fine, then check in a few months, a quarter, 6 months, a year from now. The reality is we didn't have a corporate card program up until recently, so we immediately went to the TD data and said, okay, show me what we're doing. Look at it from a 6 to 12 month period, and sure enough, there was plenty of people using it, right? So it was a situation of, do you just ignore it? Do you write it in your policy, say you can't do it, or you do it at your own risk? The reality is, as I said before, as in my opening statement, I'm still driving towards solutions. So if people are using it, we want to give them the right instructions, the right means to do that. So we went through the normal course of investigations through our risk management folks, our physical security folks, and certainly checking with our peers and interviewing all of the vendors and saying, listen, what are your solutions and how can we formalize that? So rather than ignore it or say it doesn't happen or tell people they can't, they're going to do it. They're doing it. All right. And so, so again, I love sitting in the middle because I can see both sides. But the reality is they're both viable solutions. It depends on your workforce and really depends on your culture and your policy. So I challenge you to look at it from both sides, not only from you as the travel manager, but as the traveler. All right. A day doesn't go by if I have an opportunity to ride in the Lyft, I'm riding an Uber back. Okay. Likewise, with all of the traditional car services, I'm trying those because I want to see and feel what was just described. Am I seeing it? Do I get a feel for that? Okay. I can tell you on both sides, I've gotten, I'll call it reports or service issues to it from a sleepy driver to someone who wasn't driving the right car. Okay. You get the confirmation on your app and you're looking at it going, wait a minute, how so? We understand that there's issues to both sides. There's duty of care concerns on both sides. So that's really from my perspective.
But, just out of curiosity, when you talked to Rick Spanish, what was their conclusion? What was their advice?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, again, as we historically looked at the traditional certificates of insurance, that is the standard, that's the norm, that's what folks are used to, is looking at where the state minimums, because obviously that's what was described by Zach earlier, is really kind of getting a portfolio, looking at it cross-spectrum and saying, hey, do we have any concerns? Is there a risk or is there a gap that is insurmountable? Okay. Again, depending on where your travelers are, the proponents 80-20, if you've got a state that doesn't have a suitable minimum, then it may not work for you in that particular state. So you have to make those adjustments.
Okay. Sure.
I recently met, I had a sales call. And like you said, you had multi-generations traveling for this company. Met probably to about a group of five. Two regularly use black car all the time. Like every single time, Uber, Lyft, anything else does not exist for them. Right. And the other three were young, very young. My question to them was, have they ever used black car? And they have not. It's just something that they didn't do. They didn't even try black car. It's Uber, Lyft. That's what we do.
This is the difference, folks.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so my question.
I'm old, so I have the big one.
Okay. So
I have it too.
So my question to you is, you know, you went to your risk management team. You did a little bit of research as far as comparing the two, which obviously are not apples to apples. They're two totally different things. How did you find, as far as finding outside of duty of care, safety in general, just safety in general. I mean, outside of some great points that somebody brought as far as all tires and maintenance and stuff like that, tire drivers, did you guys get us that far to find out what the safety concerns are?
Good question. So what I failed to mention is that we did a 90-day pilot with one of the providers and solicited feedback from that pilot group. Does it work? Does it not work? Things like that. So we were able to collect that because if we didn't get a positive vibe on that pilot, we certainly wouldn't move forward. So I want to make sure folks understand we did do a pilot. In fact, the pilot extended, I think, by another 30 days, not because of the provider, it was more because of us. Mm-hmm. We just really wanted to make sure. So having said that, getting back to your other point in terms of the condition of the car, the vehicle, yeah, things like
safety
that.
Safety in general.
I'll be honest with you, the number of rides that I've taken, you spend your time inside the vehicle. I observe the inside of the car more so than I look at the outside of the vehicle. Now, unless I'm seeing the vehicle come in, I'm not seeing the front of the vehicle, I'm seeing the side.
I'm more concerned about, say, like accident rates.
Right.
Recently, the AAA released a report. Accident rates in 2015 to 2016 have doubled. Now, there is something to say with the volume of untrained drivers that have flooded the market, as you stated before, the gentleman from Lyft, is that there are part-time, the majority of them. So that means that their experience behind the wheel is ridiculously minimal compared to an actual trained chauffeur. So they're contributing to, I know you said you work with insurance companies closely, is that something that you guys also see as far as accident rates, insurance claims? Now, these are things that affect everyone. It's not just the corporate traveler. It's everyone in general. You know, it's just that this person who's not trained driving, let's say, an extra 20% of the time because it's part-time, they're on the road. They're causing accidents. It's just numbers. It's going to happen. It's not blaming. It's just facts.
From my perspective, knock on wood, I've not seen that. Now, that's, again, I go back to my adage before.
Yeah, you're 130
just,
days.
Just because, well, the pilot's long gone, right? Yes, so we're full-fledged in both solutions. But the reality is we've not seen those incidents. Now, again, that's us.
Yes, of course.
So I don't know if there was kind of a question addressed to you as far as insurance claims.
I can't speak to any specifics around numbers.
So I struggle with it a lot. Our folks are using Uber because, one, we have a lot of people in the United States and around the world, but they are multi-generational. And I struggle with this. Not really trying to stop them, but my struggle is with putting the company's name on and saying it's okay. You know, we've sort of looked at it and said, we're not comparing the ride sharing to our black car, we're comparing ride sharing to taxis. And even with that, you need to be cautious, but you know, treat it like a taxi. And don't take it to or from your home, and don't take it by yourself. Because two of the biggest issues around the ride sharing are, one, whether it's the sexual harassment, that there's lawsuits prevailing, you know, so don't take it by yourself. And the second thing is, there have been situations, and there was a lawsuit where a ride-sharing driver drove someone to the airport. They chatted in the car on the way to the airport. The person went back to the house and robbed the house, knowing that no one was home. Well, because that person's an independent contractor, there's no insurance. There's nobody to hold responsible but that driver, and we all know that that driver is not going to have enough insurance or anything else to recover the things that were stolen from that home. So from my perspective, my struggle is, how do you put your name on it? Because when something happens and that company can't or won't cover it, then they're coming to you. So how did you get that through or deal with that in your organization?
Yeah, all I can say is from a risk management perspective, that's why, fortunately, we have that group to really make those assessments. And so when we bring these solutions or these ideas, because again, it started out as an idea, a concept, it's something that was in the marketplace, they're the ones that are making those assessments. I can't tell you to the nitty-gritty how they made that assessment. I just know that the person who runs our risk management department, I call him the worry word. He thinks about everything.
It's their job, isn't it?
It is. It's just fascinating having conversations with someone like that. And it's like, I just want a yes or no answer, and it's never a yes or no. So I know that they have and continue to take a look at that. I don't get to the level of degree of analyzing it, so I can't answer that question.
And that's a follow-up question for you, if you don't mind. If you mentioned these kind of specific use cases, you know, don't take it from home and things like that. How do you address that? Do you just suggest that in policy, or?
So when somebody asks me, is Uber, are we allowed to take Uber? I have actually spent a tremendous amount of time writing a script that gets sent to that person saying, remember that these ride-sharing companies, Uber and Lyft, they're an app. They're not a company. And it goes into talking about what some of the challenges are when you're using an app versus using a brick and mortar company with, you know, their own cars and whatnot, and some examples of things that have happened. And we say that, you know, it's not something that the company encourages. And we don't say no, but we say everything up to no, so that our associates are
in buyer beware.
Right, yeah. Buyer beware. We want to make sure that they're a little nervous before they do it, because they should be, and because we want to make sure that in the end, it really is CYA. I've got a name on a big building, and they'll come after us if we say, yeah, go ahead, use it.
Okay, let me address that too, what you said, because it's a real good point. I sit up here fighting for the rights of limo companies, but you're absolutely right that it is the taxis that are taking it on the chin. Most taxi companies are up between 25% and 40%. Medallions have been devalued to the point where the funding sources for those medallions are going bankrupt. I mean, there's a lot of disruption. And hey, you know what? Competition's competition. As long as everyone plays by the same rules, that's fine. Right now, 52% of all travel is done by Uber or Lyft or a similar app-based application. So, you know, you're absolutely right in that comparing it to the taxi more than the limo. And in their case, yeah, I can see their gripes. They have to go through fingerprinting, everything, permitting fees, this, that, and Uber, Lyft walk in, and they don't have to do any of that. And, you know, they do it by persuading the public, by, getting to the legislators, more so getting to their constituents than the legislators themselves, because we get to them well. You know, we all know how the game is played. But, you're right in that, and that's part of the problem for the taxes.
And you just hit the nail on the head. It's like, there is probably enough space out there for everyone, but Lyft and Uber don't play by the same rules.
Well, that's true. But I will say this, Patty, and what it's done, though, is it's really given kind of an awakening to the ground transportation industry. So now we've got people using ground transportation, be it Uber, Lyft, Royal Coachman, BBZ, Vanderbilt, whatever, flight time, that maybe wouldn't have done that before. Right. So, you know, there's different ways to look at it.
Yes, but these companies are allowing their employees to dedicate the yes, letting them use it. The perfect example was IBM. They said no to using Uber and Lyft, and their employees went in a tailspin, and then they put it right back into their program. I mean, I have been in the corporate world for almost 30 years, and if a company tells me to do this, I'm doing it. Okay, I want my job. But, you know, you're letting these younger, the millennials and the Gen X dictate your policy.
I have a question, Dix. Just touching base on what you had said, you had put together kind of like an educational brochure for your employees that have asked, correct? And you say everything up to saying no. Are you doing that, or is anyone else also doing that?
I brought a copy with me, but yeah, we just did one. Perfect. This was mid-November. Okay. Right? And
it covers
many of the points that were raised. And it's more of educational. And frankly, it resonated out of an issue. And one of the things that we surmised out of everything else was the passenger, the employee, did not verify the plate of the vehicle. And so it kind of fostered, okay, I don't want blame to go anywhere near this.
Yeah, because that's exactly what it is. It's cover yourself.
Because, right. But you know, this went out not as a CYA. I'm getting chills just thinking about any incident, whether it's Fort Lauderdale,
yes,
or this passenger in the vehicle. Okay.
We all do.
You just immediately feel for this person. You want to be in their shoes for a split second. That's all. Okay. But you want them to feel that, hey, someone is looking out for them. So this type of, hey, did you know, or FYI type of thing was not CYA. Of course, our risk management folks would love it to be CYA, but it's not, okay? For me, it was just more of, hey, if I were the associate, or I was the employee involved, I'd want to know someone's really trying to look out for me and trying to give me good guidance.
Right, but if something happens and they're on business for Broadridge, who's just going to be responsible? The deep pockets, which is going to be you. Regardless of anything that you've ever told them, Broadridge is the deep pockets.
But Patty's no different if I get into a taxi or...
Mm-hmm.
A jitney? I don't know if there's a better way to describe it. You know what I mean.
That's a whole other thing, James.
Drunk on Jersey. Jug handle jitney.
I say, how many of us have landed at LaGuardia and then you see the taxi line sticking around? I'm like, okay, it'll take Gypsy Cat. Yeah. So, that question over here, then we'll
go over here. My name is Tony from a company called Groundspan. I just want to add my two cents about this risk management thing. So we work with thousands of companies, a lot of which are in the room, and we automate ground transportation. And risk management is absolutely a factor in some of these decisions. I can tell you, several of the companies we've spoken to without mentioning names, their risk management has specifically told them, if you do not organize a program with the traditional ground transportation services and somebody uses an Uber or a Lyft, I don't want to argue each side, then the company's really fully on the hook here. We're highly liable. So you need to have an organized program with the traditional services. So God forbid if somebody does use one of these services in a rogue fashion, like a cab, and somebody gets killed or whatever these serious issues, the company is better protected. Because if you don't have a program and then they go use Uber and Lyft and somebody gets killed, you as a procurement team are not doing your job in giving them a program that is properly supported. So one of the trends that I am seeing, and it's actually doing wonders from our business, so thank you, a lot of the corporations who in 20 years I've been in the space would not even want to talk about ground are now coming to us to help them organize, centralize, and give them booking channels to leverage the flight times, the Royal Coachmans of the world. So risk management absolutely is a place you should start when you start making these decisions.
And to further what Tony said along the same lines, not only that part, but you look at the workers' comp portion of it, if someone gets hurt while they're driving one of your passengers, one of your employees around, you know who they're going to for workers' comp. They're going to you. So it's not only the auto liability side, it's the workers' comp side as well that you have to be careful of.
Part of the background check that you actually do, you do fingerprinting.
So we do a comprehensive background check system and then comprehensive accountability.
So there is no fingerprinting?
That's correct.
Okay, if you have somebody with criminal history, do you hire them?
No.
Okay, that's not true because they've been hired by your company at Uber. How about 6 or 8 points on their license? Do you do check on their motor vehicle abstract?
We do complete driving records, that's correct.
And if they have 8 points, do you hire them?
I can't speak to specifics around the numbers. I think, one of the best things to look at, and I've had the opportunity to speak to a lot of corporate travel managers, a lot of companies in this space, and I think, having a conversation, I'm certainly not a in-the-weeds specialist in terms of risk management, but companies are recognizing that this is, having a policy and, having one where they are educating employees about what is acceptable use for Lyft and Uber. I think there are a lot of scenarios where companies are willing to endorse it. Now, I'm not going to say we're a great replacement for a chauffeured vehicle with a cold six-pack of beer in the background.
That's not standard, by the way.
I'm bringing that back to the city. After this meeting, I might need it. So that's my first conversation. This is not, and this is something that is being adopted en masse by consumers. And I think a lot of you in this room have learned, have been thinking about the consumerization of travel, direct booking outside of specific channels. I think the most forward-thinking companies I'm talking to are embracing those changes and recognizing that having a policy around when ride sharing is appropriate is a good thing. It comes down to even things like employee retention. I talked to a consulting firm, one of the big four, and that's one of their key talent retention strategies, is recognizing that they need to have an employee-friendly policy around travel that they can really lean into. So I think we really welcome those tough conversations, and I think it's something that we want to explore, and we have dedicated teams of risk management specialists that can go into detail on our programs. And the companies that are doing this are really putting in place employee-friendly programs while still evaluating the risk management aspect. Because whether you like it or not, your employees are going to start voting with their wallets over time. And it's going to happen. It's happening already. I mean, Lyft had 2.5x growth to those 14 million rides last year. That's going to cascade to your employees over time.
So, Zach, I'm just curious. I don't know if you have these numbers or not, but do you know of those corporate buyers that you work with, how many of them allow Lyft versus how many of them actually have you as a preferred vendor?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's one that gets to your general policy around travel choices, whether it's airline or hotel. How important is employee choice in your travel policy? Generally find that's reflected in in Broadridge's case, you can use Lyft or you can use the other guy. It's whatever you prefer.
You're not allowed to say that word?
We went to reprogramming when I started. Versus some companies that do, have preferred, if not exclusive, relationships with Lyft. Now, obviously, full transparency, that's what we prefer. But, I totally understand. I'm never going to go to a travel leader and say, hey, you have to reinvent the wheel around your travel policy for on-demand ground transportation.
So, John, from your discussions with risk management, is there a difference in liability if it's a preferred supplier versus whether you just allow it?
It's a good question, and I did a quick read on the travel policy, and I don't recall how we have it. Going back to the earlier comment, I believe we group the shared rides under the taxi fees versus the free-range ride or the traditional. So I can't say how it's definitive or how it's defined there, but because we bucketed in that, I'll say the I don't want to call it black car, but more the taxi bucket, I can't say that we do.
Okay. I think we'll start with you.
Well, I want to change the conversation a little bit. So self-driving cars. I believe you've actually already started that experiment. And John, I'd like to know if a traditional black car, are you guys looking at that? And actually for John, as a corporate travel manager, have you even thought about that kind of
thing? We joked about it the other day. I'm looking forward to going to Pittsburgh, frankly. I'm curious. I'll put myself out there because I want to see what my folks are possibly going to be doing. So I'm interested. Am I excited? I'm a little nerdy, a little geeky, a Star Wars fan. I get it, right? So I'm very interested in that. Hold that thought for a moment. Tesla. Has already done it on regular cars that you and I can drive.
But the guy's dead.
Okay.
The guy's dead.
Okay.
So there is
one
a
guy. I'm not discounting it. Okay. But the point is, it's interesting. It's fascinating. It's so. Me personally, I'm curious. I have not done it yet, but yeah, I would like to go and see it and be and try to experience it myself. That's me. But again, I'll kind of look to the other side for their perspective.
So yeah, you want to go there?
Sure. So John Zimmer, who's one of our co-founders who went to Zimbabwe, has really, I would say, big vision for self-driving cars, and that they are going to be more widespread than people think, faster than people will think. We have partnered with GM to really focus on development of self-driving cars, and GM's going to have a new vehicle with some not entirely autonomous, but autonomous features that is actually going to be driving exclusively for Lyft in the near future. And it's something that we're really focused on helping bring this reality to us sooner rather than later. I think I actually had the opportunity to sit in a presentation from a JP Morgan analyst that's focused on self-driving cars and the economic opportunity around this. Think about all the time that anyone spends behind the wheel of a car. They have to be focused. They obviously can't be under the influence of alcohol or drugs. They can't be on their phone, exactly. Think about all those billions of hours that happen every day around the United States. Now, what if we could give those hours back to people? To work, to play, to consume food or drink or whatever the case may be. The potential to make the American worker happier because they don't have to sit in traffic, the potential to return all those hours to the economy is massive. Now, this is way down the road and a little bit beyond this, beyond the scope of this panel, but Lyft is really excited to be a part of that.
What about all those workers who are going to be out of a job?
John, we'll let you weigh on that before we go.
Okay. Yeah. You're stealing my thunder. Come on. There's no question that's coming in the future, right? There's no doubt about it. But, these same drivers that Lyft and Uber call as their partners, their end goal clearly is to get rid of them. So they're saying and doing everything about for their partners, and they get tips and they do this, but they don't want them. To us, we do want them. And when that does happen, we're going to have a whole lot more qualified chauffeurs to take care of the people we need to take care of, okay? Because to me, there's a big difference, as I said before, between a driver and a chauffeur, okay? In Pittsburgh, where it's happening every day, don't be fooled. There's still people in those cars, okay? They do not drive those cars around for Uber without anyone in them. They're a long way away from that, okay? I agree it's coming, and I agree that, it is the future, but I think for traditional limo companies, it's not there yet. And, we need to take care of our customers and give them the service that they want, opening doors, carrying luggage, special requests, all that kind of stuff. And that's what we're focused on right now, but with an eye to the future, too.
But so in other words, you at some point might go with, because I agree, I'm not sure I'd feel comfortable in a driverless car without somebody sitting in that seat, to watch out.
Right. A lot will depend on, I hate to sound wishy-washy, but a lot depends on how it goes in the economy, how it becomes accepted, because right now there's a lot of resistance to it, there's a lot of fear about it, because it's the unknown, just like any other change. So, for my company at least, and I would guess some of the other ones, It's a wait and see approach for that. But in the meantime, we're just going to try to service the heck out of you, do what we always do.
And I saw something that you say about flying cars, so we have that left to look forward to.
It's 2 years away.
So I have a question to piggyback on this. We know that this is a transportation company. We know that all the other, when you get driverless cars, do you become a transportation company or do you still be an app? And how does that? Figure out, because who's going to be responsible for the driverless cars?
Well, so I think actually our founder, John, has a really good analogy for what we see the vision of driverless cars being. And I think the closest analogy to it is your cell phone today, right? I have a cell phone. It's the hardware. This device is made by Apple. Maybe I have an Android. That's actually probably a little bit better. Samsung makes the hardware on my phone, right? And then Google makes the operating system on the phone. And then I have Verizon, which sends data in between, right? If we transfer that to driverless cars, one day you'll have someone that makes the car, like an actual hardware, like a GM or a Ford. You will have software in the car that will be integrated in. That might be Google, right? They have aspirations around driverless cars as well. And then there will be the network. Right? How do vehicles communicate to each other? How do you keep them in touch? How do you connect someone with a ride to get them somewhere?
So there's no liability. Right. So no one owns, someone has to physically own the car. There's got to be an owner of the liability. So but it almost sounds like that you still want to still be just an app company and someone else was. So are you going to help the drivers, somebody to own a car in order to own the driverless car? It almost sounds very hard to figure out what that would be, but it seems like the liability issue is still going to be that little
gray area
over here, and no one's going to be able to
There's a lot still to be figured out about this future and what it may look like, and that's someone way above my pay grade that's going to figure that out.
I think, well, let me go a little further.
Sure, sure.
I think there's another way to look at this, that first of all, they are a transportation company. Okay, anyone who's providing prearranged rides, which is what they're doing now, that's what we do. Okay, that's a transportation company. I don't care how you slice it and dice it, just because a ride comes through an app, we send our chauffeurs ride through iPads. What's the difference? It still goes through electronic means. Prearranged is prearranged. That's a limo company.
Whether
that's
it's 15 minutes or an hour, it's the same.
Right, it doesn't matter. Well, now they're doing prearranged in advance in Hudson County. So, you know, to say that they're not a transportation company, I think it is part of the problem right from the get-go, because I think they are.
Okay, this gentleman's been trying to get it for a while.
It's the beginning. And
I have a few things to say. So, I guess I have a unique, not, I don't know how unique, but a unique perspective in this room probably, because I'm a millennial, but I work for a traditional car service company. So
you must be a torn individual.
So for the driverless cars, just going to the piece about the economy and J.P. Morgan, I mean, part of it is also that you could buy a driverless car and put it to work for you. So I guess theoretically you could still have a liability of owning the car, even though you're not driving. But as much as I sometimes like seeing Zach get killed over there, I think there are also some things that I, as a consumer, am curious about. Like, not just focusing on Lyft and maybe some of the safety concerns, but, you know, I used to live in Boston, and getting a taxi was awful. And so certain things like Lyft, you know, and Uber is great. And, you know, if you think about why your travelers are maybe using those services, you know, it's about how quick the car can get to you, and, you know, for us personally, about how the cost of it. So, you know, when I crush my operations team on all the time, it's like, how are we getting to get quicker lead times, and how are we, you know, able to, like, what are traditional car companies? I guess I'm directing questions to you, John, is, you know, what, and I know what I try to get my guys to do, but what are traditional car companies trying to do to maybe meet the needs of the travelers that brought about these providers in the first place? And I get that it's not a level playing field and that should be addressed, but let's say the playing field gets level. You know, what are we doing now to fill in that gap to meet the travelers, you know, because if we could do what Lyft does with the same duty, you know what I mean, like then there's no problem. Right. But, you know, so how are we getting there?
So that's a great question. Let me preface it by saying it's challenging because we're using legit licensed operators. Okay, that makes it challenging to begin with. That being said, there are companies out there doing that right now. Okay, you have iCars, which is nationwide. You have MyRide, which is in Miami. It's doing the same thing. There's multiple platforms in the city now that utilize licensed chauffeurs. So it is happening. In our industry, there is a big movement now behind a few of the major big players to create an app, which is I'm not going to call it on-demand, but I'm going to call it near on-demand, which will help service our corporate customers and get us into that arena. Okay? You know, the problem, as you know, with licensed W-2 employees is it's hard to have the supply. That's what makes it more challenging than anything else. But that being said, we're making a push to get that product out there. It's being worked on right now. There's over 600 limo companies nationwide who have already, you know, bought in, so to speak, and there's more coming. So that remains to be seen. It is a challenge, there's no question, especially when you're using legit companies and licensed chauffeurs.
And it's also, we don't have the type of fleets the way that they do because we have higher end fleets and they go through all of the different with the chauffeurs, okay? When you have 1 million drivers throughout the entire country, we don't have that many because it's $954 to train one chauffeur. You know, all you're doing is shaking their hands, car looks great, and go on your merry little way. I mean, do you have a formalized training in-house program for your chauffeurs? Or is it online?
Well,
We don't have any drivers.
So we do have that formalized process for the back. Again, stringent background check. Yes, provide proof of all of that. Drive test. You know, I think really, I think some of the tension in this room, and make no mistake about it, we're obviously very well aware that we're disrupting an industry, is. And this isn't just happening with Uber and Lyft. It's a transformation in how people work and what the expectations are for what they want to do. And so, you know, we get asked about fingerprinting, right? Long-standing method of background check. It's one way of doing a background check. It can also take weeks to onboard someone to the platform. that's not what drivers, it's just not feasible given the model that, that these part-time drivers who may just need to earn a little extra cash, they want to drive 10, 20 hours a week to do. And I think, you know, that's just, this is really, it's ultimately both consumer, both driver and passenger choice that's driving these transformations. So our big message is we want to work with you to understand those transformations. Lyft does a lot to keep our passengers safe, way actually quite a bit more than our competitors do. And I can go into that in more detail. It's the level of our background checks. It's, again, the fact that we actually meet them, right? That's something that the other guys can't say. I guarantee you any of you in this room could download the other app, say, hey, I want to drive. You'd be driving by, what's today, Thursday? You'd be approved to drive by Sunday without having to meet someone.
3 hours.
Right,
that's
exactly.
How long it takes.
You can't say that about Lyft. It does take a little bit longer because we do require that scheduling of that in person. But that's just sort of, it is representative of, I think, the way that the nature of work and the nature of transportation in this company is going. And so we want to have, we want to embrace that debate and that conversation with all the corporate leaders in this room. And that's the job that I have.
So I'd like to jump in on that.
Sure.
You know, the real reason why Uber and Lyft don't want fingerprinting is because of the churn rate of their drivers. Okay, they blow through 68% of their drivers every month. Uber 2 months ago blew through 65,000. That means that they either took off the platform or added 65,000 drivers. Okay, that's a lot. They cannot afford to do fingerprinting because it slows down the process. They won't have enough drivers out there. Now, being that I was testifying in front of the Senate, I got to hear, you know, a fair amount of stuff, primarily from Uber. And, you know, the big question that a lot of politicians put together is, so you fingerprint in New York, which is a mile, 2 miles away across the river, why can't you fingerprint New Jersey? Do New York residents deserve more protection than New Jersey residents? Right? So, you know, to me, and that's what they said, and that was our fight all along. Why do they do it there and not here? All right, you guys know in Austin, Texas, Austin board voted to make fingerprinting mandatory. Uber, Lyft took off. And guess what? There's providers in there providing the same kind of service right now, doing on-demand legitimately. Okay, so when you really get down to it, it's the churn rate and, you know, and all that comes from is what they really can make. Because when you really get down to what they can make, you have to take out all the expenses that are associated with driving a car, which most people don't realize when they get into it. UberX, you guys know, it's cheap. It's economical. We get that. But think about it from the driver's side. You know, if you're paying $10 for a ride, that means you subtract the 25% that Uber takes, and then they're left with, what, $7.50. Then you factor in gas, excess wear and tear, insurance, everything else that's involved in running your car. What are you left with? Okay, that's the main reason we have big churn with the TNC drivers is because earnings. Okay, there's a pretty interesting website. Let me see if I can find it because I made a note down here. What's it called?
Who's driving you?
No. This is a different one. That I'll get to that. I have that one too. This one is, I apologize for not having this right here, but I will find it. Oh, it's called uberpeople.net. Okay, when you go on uberpeople.net, it's all Uber drivers, okay? And you can click on two tabs that are super interesting. One is complaints, and one is pay. And have fun reading it, because I was blown away when I did that. And in addition to that, you know, we're talking about duty of care, which is what was just said. There's two other ones. One, which the TLP puts on, which is called Who's Driving You? You go under there and you click on incidents. Hope you have a lot of time.
Daily.
And also there's an email that we're privy to in the industry called Advocates for Fairness in Transportation, which is the same thing, which lists everything that happens on the TNC front. I challenge you guys to read this stuff and look at it and think twice about your duty of care.
You know, I'm glad that John just spent 10 minutes sharing all that information about our competitor.
And well, that's the major user. That's,
you know,
when you talk about overall volume, Uber is, you know, and you can't compare. So that's what most of these people are faced with in the markets they go into.
That's why we'd love to talk to you. And, you know, I think it's, and I realize I'm sort of
there's
fighting.
There's good stuff in there too, by the way.
I'm fighting a dual battle. today. But, you know, I think that, that study, so the rideshare guy is actually a community of rideshare drivers. It's the most trafficked. And this story just came out this week. They surveyed, actually sent out to all 100,000 of their members, people who are drivers, and I think 8.2 out of 10 said they were happier driving for Lyft, and they made more money. So that really gets to, I think, culturally, when you start to look at the differences in our companies. Common themes within the feedback: Lyft treats me with respect. I'm valued as a partner. I make $3 more an hour. I think the average was $18 an hour for drivers of Lyft within that survey. And I'm happier. And you know, I think so. We want to explore this. We understand there's concerns. Now it's my turn to differentiate us against the other guys as really the right corporate choice for your employees. So again, happy to address any specific questions that you do have.
Can I bring this room back together?
Sure. I look to these two gentlemen to my right and to my left. And Patty, I think you've heard me say this in plenty of meetings that we've had. Either or both of you are only as good as your last run.
No question.
Would you both agree to that?
100%.
Would you all agree to that?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring the room back together. Okay, yeah. Go. Good job.
I want to piggyback on something John Epstein said. You mentioned the mobile app that's being developed. Most of us were at GBTA in Denver this last summer when that mobile app program was announced by two owners of, you know, the top limousine companies that we all know. So I imagine it's being worked on right now. And the main factors in this mobile app is it's basically going to mirror everything that Uber and Lyft's app do. The difference is going to be, oh, and over 100 of the top limo companies across the country, and it's growing every day, have already signed up to be a part of this program. So when it's up and going, this mobile app will do everything the ride-sharing guys do, but it says you're going to get a professional chauffeur, background checks, the whole bit. You're going to get a clear-cut liability insurance policy nationwide, and you're going to get a vehicle that we know is roadworthy and inspected every night. My question now to John Epstein, to John Wallenberg, well, not to John Epstein, because you know about it, to John Wallenberg and the other corporate buyers. Now you have a choice. Which one would you tell your employees to use if you're allowing ride sharing? Which one now makes sense, and which one might cause problems?
Should have gave it to us 5 years ago.
Right, but they are disrupting in a good way. It's okay. Happening now.
Right, but you know, the limo companies have, they've been in the
position. Should have, would have, could have. It's happening
right
now.
Well, a little late.
Different okay, industry, so. different industry. Okay, but think of the late 70s, early 80s. Automotive. American car companies could not develop more fuel-efficient, more sexier cars. Everyone poo-pooed the foreign manufacturers. They were a disruptor. Guess what? We've got competitive domestic cars now. Okay? So if a disruptor like the Ubers and Lyfts can improve and deliver an end-game solution that benefits everyone, so be it. So it's the way our economy, fortunately, works.
But the question is, if you now have a choice, if you have a Lyft or an Uber app that you're letting your employees use, but now the traditional ground transportation companies, late, as the gentleman in the back says, but it's out there finally, with all of these advantages, who would you choose?
The answer is it depends on your company, your culture, your policy.
And availability. They're doing 1,000 rides in 5 minutes. We don't even have 1,000 vehicles in the area. So, again, for us to compete in that situation, each one of these ground transportation companies have to have thousands of vehicles. Some of these people who are joining these hundreds, and I'm playing the devil's advocate here, only have 5 vehicles. And out of those 5 vehicles, 4 of them are for their corporate clients who've made pre-arranged reservations. So now they have one vehicle available for an on-demand ride. So you know, as wonderful, again, that's why I'm saying, there's room for both. They're just on two different spectrums.
No, Patty, the only problem is we're looking at one thing. Why Lyft and Uber are not regulated like us?
That's the only question. And I agree with you 100%.
And everybody's asking the same question, and nobody's answering that. Why they're not regulated?
Because they are a ground transportation program.
They call themselves technology, not transportation.
Here's the truth. We had fingerprinting locked up in the New Jersey law, okay? That was going to be in there. We worked tirelessly with Assemblyman Logano, Senator Sarlo, Senator Bucco, et cetera, et cetera. I can go on with the names and names. But what happens is their constituents get wind of it. Mm-hmm. Uber/Lyft sends out PR emails, and you guys are phenomenal at it. You're amazing. I give you all the credit in the world. It is amazing. They sent out an email this past Wednesday, Uber did, regarding trying to get the governor to sign this law. They got 14,000 signatures in a day and a half. All right, so they're marketing geniuses at that. But the bottom line is, the constituents tell the lawmakers what laws to put on the books. And that's really what it comes down to, unfortunately.
You know what, I just want to make a statement. I've been in travel and more or less in technology for probably 30 years, maybe a little bit longer, but let's give it 30 years. And in the past 10 years, I've been managing a program for a company where I manage the travel, the meetings, and the ground transportation departments, okay? So my forte to get hired in that company was because of the ability of adapting technology. And one thing that I've asked for 10 years ago, and this will even branch into meetings, is that the ground transportation vertical has always been lacking, okay? The airlines have GDS, it came out with the online booking tools. You have Cvent, you have Starsight or Lanyon, whatever. There's meeting platforms. Where's the ground transportation platform? This is what we're talking about now. So now the ground transportation platform. Okay, Tony, you're not an interface. Okay, you don't use APIs in systems. So
as a fellow travel manager, I'm going to tell you it's our fault because we haven't paid enough attention to ground. It's always been a red-headed stepchild, and we've never demanded.
Thank you.
The limo industry, the association, you know, whoever, you know, we have CBTA. You know, the limo association, I mean, you know, they should have joined hands a long time ago.
Maybe, but it's not a cornfield in Iowa. It's not if you build it, they will come. You know, it doesn't always happen that way. And you're not going to spend the time, the energy, the investment in the technology if you're not sure that it's going to actually be picked up. And for a black car, it's a huge investment in time, energy, and technology as opposed to a startup app. There's a big difference between the two. So if we had band together and paid more attention and asked for it, it probably would have been here 5 years
ago. I ended up building my own.
But, you know, I look at this a little bit differently. You know, I've been in the business a long time, and I remember years ago, travel managers, myself included, we were up in arms over online booking. This was going to be the demise of our jobs. It was going to be the demise of travel managers, travel agents, whatever. And, you know, you're either riding the wave or stuck in the surf. You got to figure out how to deal with it. For me, figuring out how to deal with it is, you know, do I put my name on it? Do I not put my name on it? But it's happening, and it is what it is. We do have to think, though, about and look and learn from what we've seen. And if you use online booking tool as something to learn from, we protested, it came, it's here. In some companies, you've got 75-80% adoption to your online booking tool.
It's become a KPI for us.
Right, and that's great. You've got all this adoption. But it's so hard now to find a qualified travel agent, and you still need them. You still need them for your complicated trips, your multi-city, you need them.
Don't go after hours.
But it's right. But it's no longer lucrative for somebody to go into that field. And it's no longer, there's no longer training schools to train people to do that job because it's all now technology and you build the technology. And we have to look at long term what some of these things do to our service levels down the line. So I'm, you know, it's great. And I keep thinking, as I said before, you want to compete against the taxis, that's fine. But competing against the black car is a completely different market. And we pay for a different service, and we need that service. And we need to protect that those jobs and still make it a viable living for somebody to be a chauffeur. And I think, you know, we as the consumers have to think about that, because we are the ones who are ultimately going to suffer from it.
If I could, just to go back to autonomous vehicles and a question to you, Zach, is, you know, it's great that you said you don't need to keep these jobs and everything else. I have a question that I've been winding back ever since you stated, you know, you're going to give back all this time, and obviously it'll be productive for people. It'll get back more income in general, let's just say, for someone who's lost time for whatever. A friend of mine, Rick Edelman, he does a show on 80. He does the Rick Edelman on the weekend. This book comes out in March. Buy it. It's going to be great. But the point
is,
the question that I have is, you know, is this automation will change everything. Coming down to, as you said, for us in general, our towns, our states, our individual cities will lose revenue. If cars are automated, there will no longer be a massive need for policemen to monitor speed. Traffic violations, all this parking tickets, all this revenue that is generated that makes jobs will be gone. Because I will be the first person to tell you, where I live, parking is a disaster. I get a ticket once every 2-3 months, $60, well worth my not having to walk 3 blocks to get my groceries. But I'll be the first person to know, take my automated car, park me in front of my house, and then car, go find somewhere to park, come back at 8 a.m. I would love to do that, but there is a disruption that I don't believe anyone really knows how deep it will become, and it will affect us, not just for us, but the entire nation, world in general, will lose this revenue. Has that been something that you guys thought about?
I can tell you what, we could have sat in this room 15 years ago and thought of, you know, talked about how the internet and Amazon was going to do the same thing to your local Sears, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the economy evolves, the nature of work changes and what people do and revenue sources evolve. And I think it's going to happen, you know, technology is going to accelerate all those changes going forward. It's going to happen. I really can't speak to the nature of it. Really, probably not even smart enough to comprehend most
of it.
Well,
no, it was just because, you know, she did mention
sure. That,
like, as a travel manager, as travel managers in general that are responsible for corporate travel, it is important that we protect certain things to not go past a certain point. You know, like separation of church and state, there's a reason for that. It's the same thing. I think it's important to us as a people, as a travel manager, to make that line. You know, like you said, Lyft, taxis, A. Royal Coachman, BBZ, B. Not the same. And I think it's important that you guys that everyone does that in general.
Great. We'll take one more. I'm going to quickly hit one more topic, and then I know we're running a little short on time, but hopefully we can.
I guess in an effort to bring it back a little bit as well. So just going back to the rules and regulations, right? This is beyond just an app. And by the way, Marty, we do have apps and platforms that you can tap into. We have, whatever. I don't want to sell the room, but anyway.
Don't want to sell the room?
Yeah. not like this. So it's beyond an app at this point, right? So I can give apps to every client in this room that we're working with. But it's not going to matter, because if they're able to charge $8 for a trip that these guys can only at the lowest possible rate charge $60, the app doesn't matter anymore. It's beyond an app. It's at the price point. And that's where the leveling and the equality of the regulation and the rules is really relevant here. Because I can tell you, every one of my clients, we give them an app to book their preferred ground transportation vendors. Number one, every one of these corporates are reluctant to get behind an app yet, because they're still not sure of how the app world's going to play out. So they all want it, but none of them are getting behind it the level they need to. But even if I gave it to them, it's not going to matter, because they still can't compete. I have friends in the industry, and I can't get as cheap from my friends at cost versus what they charge. So So that's where the real issue is. If you don't have equality on terms of how people are regulated and pricing and costs that are associated with these services, the app is irrelevant. It's beyond the app. It's at a cost point now that can't be competitively met. And that's the bigger issue that really has to be addressed. And that's back to what Shadi was talking about. You know, it's about the rules and regulations.
Right. And that's actually a great lead into the question I wanted to pose to John. And it's a lot of travel buyers, you know, we talk about duty of care, and I knew that would be the majority of our conversation, and that's understandable. But a lot of these travel buyers are reporting into procurement. So is there an angle? Did you look at savings? Was that a decision at all when you were looking at this?
It absolutely is, and I'm glad you mentioned that there is a cost differentiation. And so when you're looking at that, we continually get pressures from our CFOs, from our budget owners. You know, how can we do this differently? We still have to get from point A to point B, but going back to my original statement is, what are your solutions to get things done? And gosh, yes, this is one solution. So is this. All right, differentiating it. When do you need this versus when do you need this? That's the feedback we have to give to our constituents, to our leaders, right? And again, some organizations, they're very straightforward. You can do this, you can't do this. Other organizations, you can try this, you can try this, you can try that. You have to decide on your own what fits your need. That's the best way at least for my company, that's how we're looking.
Right. And Zach, just on the topic of savings, I know there's been studies done, and it's not always, ride-sharing is not always going to be the bigger savings, even if you're just looking at it from that angle. But when you work with a corporation, you're not necessarily offering discounts, correct?
So yeah, it kind of gets to, I'm sounding like a broken record about this point. Lyft treats our drivers better than the competition does. And actually our business is really low margin. We give 82 cents of every dollar spent on the Lyft platform to the driver, and in many cases that's even higher. So, you know, economically, we don't really have the ability, you know, there's not much meat to cut off the bone there when it comes to that. So, from a corporate relationship, it's more macro shifting away from taxis, which on average are about 35% cheaper than a taxi. National average, that varies. That's where a company really starts to realize savings, is moving behaviors from taxi specifically is the most common comparison to Lyft.
But how do they measure that?
Yeah, great question. We tend to collaborate around expense data. I think that's one of the things that obviously a benefit of corporate partnership has reporting. You can get information on your trips and a lot more visibility than you would with potentially even a handwritten taxi receipt, which the concept now is sort of hard to imagine that we've dealt with that for so long. Looking at over time, if we say, hey, you know, in fiscal year 2017, if we can shift 30% of your taxi trips to Lyft, we've got those national averages, we can assume a savings of hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's basically the calculation that we do, and then we tend to compare that to expense data after the fact to measure how we're attaining against those targets.
Okay. And John, have you explored any of the newer offerings they're doing, like some of these immediate auditing, let's say, because I know that they'll say if you have an employee who expenses a ride that picked them up 2 a.m. at a bar, and it's probably not a business ride. So, and they expect that as a business ride, it kind of flags that right away. Are you utilizing any of those sorts of things?
We have not. Certainly on an as-needed basis, from time to time, we'll get calls from HR, from legal, saying, hey, whether it be cell phone data or travel data, we'll commit to providing that information. But we're not actively pursuing it. It's just a resource. A, it's a resource issue. B, it's also Big Brother. How much do we really want to do this? And my company has chosen not to at this point. But on a case-by-case basis, we will if there's a particular investigation that is being sought.
Yeah, well, great. All right, so we still have a little bit more time, so we'll hit a few more questions.
Just one question for John. What's your policy statement in regards to the sharing economy?
Well, again, just talking transportation.
Yeah.
Because that's where I want to address that. Yes. So it is. We allow it. We don't promote anything, okay, in the policy. That's not the intent of
right.
that.
So
your portals are where you're gonna promote things, right? But as it relates to the policy, we certainly support it and allow it. We had a revision. We had a significant revision aside from this aspect. Within the last year, okay, it was the first major revision we had in many, many years. we took stuff off of there that just, to the point we're talking about before, just didn't exist. I mean, the policy was 10 years old. Yes, things existed 10 years ago are gone. Well, why do you even have it in there? So we did a tremendous update. And so we got to the point, because we were negotiating with his competitor and then eventually signed him mid last year. All right. we had to acknowledge it, because we were going through the pilot at that point. Or actually, we were at the post pilot, so we were going live. And I said, we can't not include that. We have to. So we accept it. I don't want to say we encourage it or promote it. Certainly on our portals, when we look at differentiating rides, right? Again, how we have it today, Nancy, right, is pre-range versus on-demand. That's where the promotion is there. But we give equal time, equal presence. We don't have a preferred, either on this side or this side of the table. We'll say, here are the four or five approved vendors. Use these. You choose not to use these, or you have a reason to use someone else, that's on you. And I hope for your sake you get reimbursed. I can't say that they won't, but I always put that caveat out there.
Yes? Quick question. A lot of this came up throughout the conversation here today. And one of the takeaways that I have is I'd like to see a comparison of Lyft, Uber, chauffeur service car, black car, and the benefits thereof, what the requirements are, the background checks, how frequent. The fingerprinting, yes or no, the training, the how frequently the cars are looked at and so forth. That would give a travel manager like myself the opportunity to present to our risk management department what we should do, because I know it's at my organization, I'm no longer there a couple months, I don't think we have a policy. And my question is, number one, is that in existence? Is anybody aware of something like that?
It sounds like
I need
it. It will be soon.
I have put something together to send out on LinkedIn and stuff, because I do that stuff for the company. But I haven't put Lyft, Uber, and us.
A good salesperson always has the comparison.
Yeah, I have Uber and us, but not Lyft. And I do want to say thank you for coming today.
Lines
down. Taking a lot of
taking a
hits.
I'm the other one. So,
and I don't know, Diane. I think this can be a part two.
Absolutely. Yes. I wish we had another hour, but unfortunately, we're just saying
maybe you guys would be willing to do a part two, and down the road a little ways. That would be great.
Absolutely.
15 minutes. Let's go back at it.
All right.
You're going.
I just want to say thank you again to the panel, the moderator, panelists, excellent, the great crowd, conversation, great questions. We're going to do the raffle now, and Bruce, go ahead. Okay, come on, Bruce. Go ahead. Somebody pull
Make
that.
Sure they know it's an office.
Hold on, I'll take
Pull out those tickets. 4-3. Yeah?
4-3-1-3-2-1. And what is this for?
This is for the you? Wonderful.
That's for the basket and the United Airlines. So I need your card so I can get you in touch.
Okay.
So before we go, I just want to say our next meeting is March 16th. It's our annual State of the Airport address, where the Port Authority will come in, United will get a big update. That's going to be at the Ramada. We're just working it out. I think it's going to be off airport this time at the Ramada East. The Ramada at the airport. So, but that'll be on our website. We're just working that out. That's one of our really fantastic meetings where we get that Port Authority update on what's going on at Newark Airport. So we'll see you then. Thank you again, everybody.